And we opened up with David Bridie from Australia, the song Permanent Water, and in parentheses says Umari. I'm not sure if that's in an Aboriginal language. It might be from there. And that was from his 2019 release, The Wisdom Line. This is Jeff Spitzer-Resnick, your host. I've been assisted by Arno today. Appreciate that. We're going to be checking out the BBC News at 12:01, followed by Alan Ruff hosting a public affair. We're going to do a little, we've got some manual studio switching we need to do. We've got a broken part, but we've got staff on hand to do it. So you'll hear about, hopefully, only about 5 seconds of dead air after the BBC News and before Alan Ruff comes on. But stay tuned. The show will definitely come on. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has made a bleak assessment of the war in Gaza, warning that it put the Middle East on the precipice of a full-scale regional conflict. Alluding to Iran's attack on Israel, he said recent days had seen a perilous escalation. He called for restraint on all sides, saying it was time to end the bloody cycle of retaliation.
The international community must work together to prevent any actions that could push the entire Middle East over the edge with a devastating impact on civilians. Let me be clear, the risks are spiraling on many fronts.
Two jurors have been excused from serving in Donald Trump's criminal trial as jury selection continues on day three of the former US president's criminal trial. With more details, here's Neda Taufik.
The first excused juror was a young female nurse who told the judge that her friends and family had discovered she was a likely juror. She felt, after sleeping on it, that outside opinions could affect her ability to be fair and impartial. The judge said she would have been a very good juror and told news outlets to no longer include employer details in reports. The second was an IT consultant, originally from Puerto Rico, who said he found Donald Trump fascinating. Prosecutors wanted him questioned, fearing he wasn't forthcoming about his criminal history. He was ultimately excused.
An Iranian woman whose 16-year-old sister was killed during anti-government protests 18 months ago has been arrested for not covering her hair. Aida Shakarami's mother says she was detained on Wednesday. Aida's sister, Nikah, disappeared in 2022, soon after the death in custody of Mahsa Amini, whose arrest for not wearing a hijab sparked months of widespread protests. Her sister's arrest comes during a crackdown this week by morality police on women breaching Iran's strict hijab rules. The US and Britain have announced new sanctions on Iran targeting the country's drone aircraft production after its attack on Israel last weekend. The US Treasury Department said the sanctions were against 16 individuals and two firms. Here's Nomia Iqbal.
Iran is already one of the heaviest sanctioned countries in the world. The latest round of punishments target executives of an engine manufacturer that supplied the drones Iran used in the attack against Israel, the companies that service the engines, and people associated with providing the drones to Iran's proxy forces throughout the Middle East. Companies linked to Iran's steel industry are also being targeted. These sanctions are aimed at cutting off the Islamic Republic's missile and drone program and further isolating the country globally. But it's likely also a signal from the US to Israel that there's no need for a military response to Iran.
BBC News. The Kenyan government says one of its military helicopters has crashed. There are reports that several senior army officers, including the defence chief, General Francis Ogola, died in the crash in the Rift Valley in the west of the country. Three soldiers are said to have survived. The German foreign minister has warned Russia against trying to recruit agents to carry out attacks in German soil. Annalena Baerbock's comments came after two men were arrested in Bavaria on suspicion of spying for Russia and planning sabotage attacks in military sites that assist Ukraine. Here's Gordon Carrera.
What's significant is the suggestion this wasn't simply intelligence gathering, the kind of normal spying you'd expect, but actually plans for sabotage, for carrying out some kind of explosions or arson at those sites. German media also reporting that one of those sites is where US military train Ukrainians on their tanks. And the suggestion, certainly from German authorities, is that this was linked to Ukraine and an attempt to undermine German support for military action in Ukraine against Russia.
Global health experts have reached agreement on common terminology to describe airborne pathogens. It aims to overcome a repeat of the confusion surrounding the various scientific terms describing how the COVID-19 virus was thought to be transmitted through the air. The World Health Organization says airborne pathogens should be called infectious respiratory particles. The Bombay Stock Exchange has warned investors against a deepfake video of its chief executive officer, giving investment and stock officials were permitted to recommend or promote any stock. The warning came after the video impersonating the CEO emerged on a platform. BBC News.
Celebrate 50 years and toast to the next half century and free adult literacy education. From 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th at Boardman Clark, you can enjoy signature cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, and a program that features speeches from Lupita Montoto of La Movida and other supporters. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at literacynetwork.org/50th celebration. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 21st. In addition to the event, you can also check out the silent auction, which is live now through April 25th. That's a toast to 50 years of Literacy Network at Boardman Clark, 1 South Pinckney, from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th. You are listening to WORT Madison.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. No power frequency radio.
And good afternoon, and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. While campus protests over Israel's genocidal war on Gaza have continued in recent months, so have attacks on academic freedom and free speech at universities across the U.S. The latter has not just come from university administrations and pro-Israel groups, but directly from a coordinated effort emanating from high levels of the Israeli state in what appears to be a campaign to shape U.S. public opinion and neutralize opposition to Israel's war. In a report last fall, one of the largest Israel's largest media outlets, the conservative Y News, disclosed that the Israeli government has launched a wide-ranging covert campaign to harass, intimidate, and silence critics, students, faculty, and administrators across the U.S. With us today is the activist and scholar William Robinson, a distinguished professor of sociology, global studies, and Latin American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. William Robinson is the author of the recent Truth Out article entitled, Israel Has Formed a Task Force to Carry Out Covert Campaigns at U.S. Universities. William Robinson, welcome to WORT.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Let's jump right in here. Tell our listeners about the Strategic Task Force plan. Who has been involved in the planning, and what is its intent?
Yeah, so the intent is to crush any dissent on U.S. campuses, any attempt at solidarity with Palestine, any attempt to oppose the genocide that's being carried out. Now, the Israeli state, and of course the Zionist lobby, the Israel lobby in the United States, has been doing this for years, for decades actually. But what we're seeing right now is an incredible escalation, a simply unprecedented McCarthyist crackdown on free speech, academic freedom, and the right to assembly on U.S. university, college and university campuses. So we now have this evidence of a radical escalation of direct Israeli state intervention in our campuses. This is really a smoking gun. And by the way, this news was not leaked last fall, but actually just last month. So the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Diaspora Affairs, and the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, and we can assume also with the participation of Mossad, which is the Israeli equivalent of the CIA, they drew up an action plan and a task force to carry it out here in the United States. And the plan calls for, and I'm going to quote directly from it, inflicting economic and employment consequences on anti-Semitic. Now, I have to stop the quote. Every time you hear that word anti-Semitic, what that means is pro-Palestinian anti-genocide. So the plan calls for, going back to the quote, inflicting economic and employment consequences on anti-Semitic students and compelling universities to distance them from their campuses. And then it specifies that the actions that the Israeli state will take in conjunction with its agents here in the United States, quote, should not have the signature of the state of Israel on it. So this is a massive covert operation. Now, from there, it goes on to identify what it calls as axes, these four axes of action that the task force will undertake. Of course, I can go into detail on each of these four axes, but what I want to say also is that if we have a quick review of the crackdown taking place, just some highlights of this crackdown taking place all over U.S. campuses, you see this in full operation. If I may have just a moment to point out some of the leading cases here, just a couple days ago, here at the University of Southern California, the valedictorian, Asna Tavassum, she was supposed to give the valedictorian address and commencement address, and she was barred from doing that because of a social media post. We know the very high-profile cases of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania, where the presidents were forced to resign, not because they were defending Palestinian lives, but just because they did not crack down hard enough on pro-Palestinian student mobilizations. We have Columbia and Bernard, where Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voices for Peace have been banned. The president of Columbia was just brought before Congress yesterday, being told that she needs to really crack down much harder. You're in Madison, so not far away in the University of Michigan. They just passed a new decree paving the way for this extreme repression of against protests of all kinds on campus. In Claremont, which is 50 miles south of where I am right now, Claremont College, the students were having a peaceful protest. The administration called in riot police, 22 squad cars and dozens of riot police arrested the students and expelled them. You know, I can go on and on. I have a long list here if you or your listeners want to hear more of these cases. But this is simply an unprecedented crackdown. And really, we're seeing the suspension of the U.S. Constitution on colleges and campuses. And now we can link it directly to the Israeli state at the highest level. Again, I just read one little quote from the introduction to that task force they set up. And then they have these four axes that identify the different areas where they will go after pro-Palestinian anti-genocide voices in our campuses.
Let's stick with some of these axes. That is, talk about the consciousness axis. What did it call for?
Yeah, so, and again, so this is going to be a direct quote. It says, it calls for the personal, economic, and employment repercussions for the distributors of anti-Semitism. Then it goes on to say the task force will, again, these are all quotes, to carry out naming and shaming by publicizing the names of those generating anti-Semitism on campuses, both students and faculty, and impacting the employment of those identified as the perpetrators. Those targeted will struggle to find employment in the U.S. and will pay a significant economic price for their conduct. And then it goes on the same consciousness axis to say the foreign ministry and Israeli representatives in the U.S. are in contact with professional unions to recruit them to act against anti-Semitism and exert pressure on university heads. If a university knows that the chances of its students finding employment have decreased, the university administration will act against those anti-Semitic students to avoid harming the university's ranking. So here we have the explanation of this incredible pressure, not just placed on students and faculty to not speak out against the genocide, but on university administrators to crack down on those voices. And that's exactly what we have been seeing. And we've also seen that outside, the corporations are firing their employees who might sign a petition, who might post something on social media condemning the genocide, or they're not being hired. And that message is going right to students, and students are about to graduate. You're going on the job market. You better be very quiet here on campus and when you get off campus. The listeners might know that I think there's 20-some-odd employees of Google were just fired because they protested Google's involvement with giving this technology to the Israeli military. So this is the first of these four axes that we're facing.
Continue with the axes. What comes next?
So then the second is, I get to the second and the third and the fourth, but I want to point out that, again, the objective here is to have faculty, students, administrators and off-campus journalists and politicians and even Palestine solidarity activists have this chilling effect where we're scared to speak out and therefore we self-censor. And it is so revealing that the University of Maryland just a couple weeks ago carried out a nationwide poll and found that 82% of faculty on our colleges and in our colleges and universities felt the need to self-censor. I want to point that out. But so the second of these axes is called the legal axis. And here is the direct quote. The Israeli government action plan calls for taking legal action outside the law. Now, I have to say, I don't exactly know what they mean by outside the law. Against activities and organizations that pose a threat to Jewish and Israeli students on campuses, such as Students for Justice in Palestine. And then that was the direct quote. It adds, open up quotes again, Israel will hold discussions with elements from the U.S. Department of Justice to map out legal tools that can be used. And of course, we can talk about that link between the Israeli state repression of free speech and academic freedom on our campuses and the role of the United States. Of course, this genocide is not just an Israeli genocide. We have to be clear, it's an Israeli-U.S. genocide. The U.S. provides diplomatic and political support, economic support, massive military aid, and deflects any criticism from Israel and represses us if we condemn that genocide. And then it says to the Israelis, well, you do the dirty work. So really, this is a U.S. U.S.-Israeli genocide, and that's what we're seeing with this plan right here. It's coordinated at the highest levels of the U.S. state also. So that's the legal axis. That's number two. The next axis is called the economic axis. And it says, and again, I open quotes, Israel will identify leading donors within the Jewish and Israeli communities and enlist them in the struggle to serve as a lever of pressure on university heads to act against anti-Semitism. Israel will exert pressure on Jewish and non-Jewish donors to withdraw their investment from campuses where anti-Semitism is not addressed and promote economic sanctions against universities receiving federal or state public funding for non-addressing anti-Semitism on campuses. Now, I want to point out this has also been very effective. Remember in the Harvard case that one Jewish American Zionist donor publicly, very publicly announced, I'm withdrawing several hundred million dollars in donations to Harvard's endowment. And he was sending a message all across the United States to administrators, to universities. See what I just did with Harvard? You better crack down on anti-genocide voices on your campus. Now, I want to point out one other thing with this third axis, the economic axis, and that is that we've seen a especially publicly funded university. We've seen, of course, this is true from K to 12 as well, but we've seen a cutback on public funding of government funding of higher education. So our university, University of California, we are severely underfunded. And over the last 20 years, there's been a shift from public funding to tuition-driven funding, but also in a big way to corporate and private donations to the universities. So our university, for instance, University of California, is very dependent on the military-industrial complex for donations for paying for the university, and those are the same, and for the tech corporations, very, very big donors to the University of California, and those donors are making a killing, literally, that's not a pun intended, with their economic business activity in Israel. So this economic axis is also extremely significant. And then finally, the last of these four axes, the Israeli government calls it an explanatory axis. And it involves, and here's the direct quote, creating a toolbox available to pro-Israeli professors and students, assisting them in addressing claims against the pro-Israel side physically and especially on social networks. The foreign ministry will explore the option of launching a campaign on social networks focused on campuses. So I have to explain with this fourth and final of these axes that this is, of course, not new, how the Israeli state and the Israel lobby worldwide and you know, based in Washington, actually based all over the United States, how it links up on campuses with all these campus Zionist groups. So how this works, the Hebrew word hasbara, translates as public perception or public diplomacy, which basically means propaganda. So for a long time, this has been going on, where the Israeli government, free of charge, invites Jewish Americans, in this case, including professors and students, free of charge, brings them to Israel, trains them, indoctrinates them in Zionism, trains them on how to go back and be agents of the state of Israel on our campuses. This has been going on for a long time, and now it is escalating. And what this axis is saying is we're going to continue and we're going to escalate that, but now we're also going to target social media. And let me explain why social media here is so important. It's because there was a poll in late 2023, and it showed that people that are 40 and over in the United States disproportionately support the U.S. policy towards Israel and support Israel. And the poll, the analysis of the poll was because they get their news from corporate media, from CNN, from MSNBC, from the New York Times, et cetera. And these corporate news outlets, we know, are unbelievably biased in favor of Israel. In fact, very often they're simply mouthpieces for Israeli propaganda, whereas young people, those people that are students on college campuses, they don't get their news from there. They get their news and information from social media. And in fact, one remarkable thing that we are seeing here is that this genocide is being live streamed on social media, but being live streamed by Palestinians themselves with their cell phones, are filming the genocide going on and posting it up in social media. So young people can see the truth about what's going on, and they disproportionately are calling not just for a ceasefire, but are increasingly turning against the Zionist project. They see through the propaganda of that project. So this fourth axis, to conclude, this so-called explanatory axis, is also targeting social media in a big way. And I there's certainly no evidence, but I wouldn't be surprised that part of the reason that the U.S. state wants to ban or crack down on TikTok is because Instagram and TikTok have been these two critical sources of direct social media information coming out of Gaza by Palestinians. So just to conclude, we are seeing this radical criminalization of Palestine solidarity, of anti-genocide political activity on our campuses.
Under that fourth axis, that is the explanatory axis or Hasbara axis, you talk about their plan to send influencers to U.S. campuses. I thought that was very interesting indeed.
Yes, absolutely. So this has been going on for a long time. The Israeli government issues what's called Hasbara fellowships. So then you go to Israel and you get trained on how to influence them on U.S. university campuses, and you see it all the time. You know, I want to mention, speaking about those influences on our campuses, so the Israel lobby, we've heard that term, and it's really a misnomer because it's much more than a lobby. First of all, it is a lobby which is embedded in U.S. civil society, in political institutions, in the corporate world. It's embedded in U.S. society, this lobby. And it's not like the gun lobby, or it's not even like the military industrial complex lobby, because they operate to try to influence legislatures for budgetary issues in Washington, or even for legal issues. But if I speak out against for gun control on my campus, the lobby doesn't come after me and try to get me fired, or as a student, try and get me expelled from the university. Even the military-industrial complex doesn't do that. You can talk out against military funding, for, you know, military profit-making at wars around the world. No one comes after you. No one blacklists you. So this is even more than a lobby. And part of the story there is just what you pointed out, influences. You set up this incredible network in every nook and cranny in the United States and on our campuses to police and to criminalize and get rid of us and neutralize anything we say against this genocide. You know, we have organizations that many of your listeners will already be familiar with. You have Anti-Defamation League. It sounds nice as if it's, you know, against racism. Nothing of the sort. It's a far right, basically almost a paramilitary, you know, this force repressing us. We have AIPAC, American Israeli Political Affairs Committee, the most powerful organization in Washington influencing policymakers. Just about every member of the Senate and Congress is financed by AIPAC. They're going to be spending $100 million. On these presidential and general elections this year in 2024. But on campus, we have these influences that you're referring to. We have this whole string of organizations that are all operating on my campus. The David Project, AMCHA, Canary Mission, Israel on Campus Coalition, Students Supporting Israel, CAMRA. And on our campuses, if you don't know, you think that these are Jewish or not even Jewish, just pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist organizations that are exercising their free speech rights along with all the rest of the student organizations on campus. And when you dig deeper, you'll find that they are agents of the Israeli state, and they're coordinating their actions with Mossad, with the Israeli state at the highest levels.
You're listening to William Robinson, a scholar activist at University of Southern California, Santa Barbara, excuse me. We're talking about this action plan that's come into use, coming from Israel to affect politics, and to certainly affect, in an attempt to affect opposition to what's been going on in the Israeli war on Gaza. I want to, William Robinson, I want to stick for a second with this influencers. That is one thing leapt out at me. I found very interesting. That is the focus on influencers from human rights, diversity, and gender identity realms. Talk about that a little bit. Why that's so important.
Well, the reason this is so important is because we are very sensitive on our campus to diversity, equity, inclusion. DEI is part of the agenda now on all U.S. university campuses. And also because we're all concerned about issues of anti-racism, issues anti-sexism. I mean, the Uterus University community tends to be, and there's another point to make here on this, where it tends to be very concerned about these broader issues. So if the Zionist strategy is that it wants to influence people at U.S. university campuses, liberals, left, the progressive, it has to get on board with these issues. So it attempts to say, look, we're leading, we're carrying out this repression, they don't use the term repression, this repression, this criminalization of dissent. We're doing so in the name of diversity, and in the name of against anti-Semitism. And no one wants to be associated with anti-Semitism. We should get into that in this interview, because, of course, the anti-genocide and pro-Palestinian support has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. We know that the Israeli state, the Zionist project, has weaponized anti-Semitism. It's changed the definition of anti-Semitism, and the U.S. government has adopted the changed definition. So now anti-Semitism is defined as criticizing the Israeli state, as being coming out against Zionism. And we know that Zionism has nothing to do with Judaism. Zionism is a right-wing political ideology and project. It goes back to racial nationalism that swept through Europe and the United States in the late 19th century. Here in the United States, it gave us manifest destiny. Racial nationalism argues that every group on the planet belongs to some racially pure group, and each racially pure group should have its own country, and in that country, no one but the racially pure group should live there. And so, of course, that was the same ideology, racial nationalism, that gave rise to Nazism. There's a pure German Aryan race, and no one in Germany should be there except the German Aryans. So the Zionists adopted that racial nationalism ideology, but said now we need a pure Jewish state, that Jews are a biological category and they need their own state. You know, that's the emergence of of Zionism. I kind of got lost on how that was how I got to that, to explaining that with your original question. Yes, I remember. So of course, when you're anti-Zionist, that has nothing to do with Judaism, which is a religion of universal values, which is against Zionism. Judaism, the true values of Judaism, is anti-Zionist. So if you twist the meaning of anti-Semitism to say that it's anti-Zionist, then you can further manipulate and you can legitimate your repression of voices of dissent against the Israeli state and against this genocide.
Again, you're listening to William Robinson, activist scholar. We're talking about the Israeli task force plan to influence public opinion here in the U.S. and to clamp down on opposition to Israel's war on Gaza and the Palestinian people. Why the stepped-up approach? That is, as you mentioned, a lot of this has been around for some time now. If you look at, for instance, the boycott divestment campaigns and the attempts to basically to neutralize that movement, that it's a lot of it is old stuff. But why the concern now?
Yes, that's a great question, and that's very important. And it's because this genocide has shocked the world. It has touched off a raw nerve here in the United States, of course, and also all around the world. And it has sparked an unprecedented upsurge of solidarity with Palestine, an unprecedented awareness of the true nature, the neo-fascist nature of this Zionist project. And so that is why you see the escalation of repression and criminalization, because they are countering, they're trying to counter this unprecedented upsurge of solidarity and of awareness. In fact, for the longest time, I want to speak a moment about the Jewish American community, because leading this protest against the genocide are Jews, especially young Jews. Jewish Voices for Peace is the largest anti-Zionist Jewish organization in the United States, and I think it's the largest one in the world. And all of these protests we're seeing on campuses and off campuses are led by young Jewish American students. Now, that has the Zionists, it has the Israeli state, really freaking out, extremely, extremely worried, because the only way that this Zionist project has survived is by unconditional U.S. government backing of Israel, which continues as we speak. And the social base, the political base for that backing, has been multiple bases, but one of the big bases has been the Jewish American community, which has been indoctrinated into Zionism, a significant portion of it. Of course, that didn't come about out of nowhere. Historically, the Zionist project had to suppress and repress the anti-Zionist sentiment that prevailed in the Jewish American community up until the post-World War II period. So why is this plan come around now? Why this escalation now? Because not only do we see this unprecedented level of solidarity with Palestine, but we see that the Zionist hegemony in the Jewish American community is cracking up. It's cracking up. And so that has them extremely worried. I just add, because I said there's several key constituencies for inside U.S. civil society and the population for U.S. government unconditional support for Israel. The other big constituency, of course, is right-wing, far right-wing extremist Christian fundamentalists. And according to their ideology, and they are the real anti-Semites. This is the irony here, that the far right are the real anti-Semites, and the far right supports Israel. The Christian Zionists, they are, but also the Christian fundamentalist Zionists, they say that the Messiah will not return, the second coming of Christ will not happen until a new Jewish kingdom is established. It reaches its height of its power, and then it will be destroyed, and then there will be the second coming of the Messiah. That's Christian fundamentalist ideology, and so they support Zionism. But ironically, it's the same far-right forces that are anti-Semites. Remember the Take Back the Right, the right activity in North Carolina during Trump's presidency. I forgot the exact year of it. I think it was 2017. time. Those right-wing forces were anti-Semites. They were yelling, "We want the Jews take over." And yet those same right-wing forces are the ones that back Israel and back Zionism. How ironic here.
Yeah, no, the slogan, that's horrific slogan, Jews will not replace us at Charlottesville. I'm sorry, I lost track here. Let's go back to, I want to open up the phone lines. We really should do that. I'm sure there are callers interested in this program and what you have to say. So if you want to get in with a question, a comment, an observation for our guest today, William Robinson, give us a call at 608-256-2001. Let's talk about the playbook of tactics. You've touched on them quite a bit, but are there others we should touch on here?
Yes. Yeah, so let me mention how this works, because I myself was a victim of this campaign, a big, large-scale campaign against me. And in 2009, for 6 months, this Israel lobby tried to have me dismissed from the University of California. They were unsuccessful, but the campaign lasted for six months. So first of all, they do character assassination. They try and denigrate you, and that's the naming and shaming that they're doing right now. Then there's selective misquotation. Joseph Mossad, who is a professor he's a Palestinian professor at Columbia University. You might recognize his name because he was mentioned by yesterday in the congressional hearing. They brought in the president of Columbia University, and he was condemned in Congress. He wrote a chapter in the book that I co-edited, We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics. And it's so horrible, the unbelievable repression against him for years now. And part of that is the character assassination. Part of it is misquotation. So I say, I can say something to you, take 2 to 3 minutes to say it, and you take out one or two words and manipulate it. That happens all the time. Then there's the willful distortion of the record. Then there's fabrication and falsehoods, outright fabrications and outright falsehoods. That shouldn't surprise us. Those of us who study what, for instance, the CIA does around the world with U.S. interventions is you simply make things up. But this is intimately part of the playbook of the Israel lobby here and the Zionist project. Just complete disregard for the truth. Then there's gaslighting. I mean, it's so unbelievable that here you have Netanyahu, who, I'm going to use the word, he is a fascist. He's a fascist, but he's organizing a genocide. Think about the significance of genocide, the crime of crimes. And every time he gets up there, he just gaslights us all. He says the IDF is the most moral army in the world, and they just hide us because we're Jews, etc. Then there's blacklisting targeted individuals that we already discussed. There's political and there's economic blackmail. Part of that playbook, again, is you tell administrators, we're going to pull funding from you if you don't crack down on this and that person. Then there's the threat of violence. Look, in 2009, and then again this past fall, as soon as October 7th happened, I stepped up my solidarity work with Palestine. For the record, I also condemned the atrocities that Hamas committed against the civilians. But that's not the relevant point. The relevant point is I suddenly was being attacked again on my campus. There was actually another complaint against me. This one lasted 3 months, and then it was dismissed. But I received death threats. They identified my children who don't live in California. They're grown up now. And they said, we're going to go after them and we're going to kill them. I mean, these barbaric things, this is all part of the playbook, this incredible intimidation and then real repression, real sanctions, real consequences. Let me mention, I have tenure, and again, I've had two attacks against me. I've survived both of those attacks. But just 2-3 days ago, a professor at Hobart and William Smith College was dismissed. She was dismissed because of a blog post in Verso Blog. And a professor at Texas Tech University, the poor guy didn't have tenure. He had a social media post. He was fired. There's a professor at Indiana University, and he was fully tenured. All he did is book a room for a Palestine event, and he was barred from continued teaching, right? At John Jay College in New York City, the contract of a professor who had been teaching for 17 years, an adjunct professor, his contract was canceled because of a social media post. right? So all of this is part of the playbook, and we're seeing all of the consequences. Remember at Columbia, which is in the news because yesterday there was that congressional hearing. Columbia, they expelled a whole group of students.
608-256-2001. If you want to get in, join this conversation with a comment, an observation with William Robinson, give us a call again, 608-256-2001. William Robinson, Zionist Hasbara in the U.S. has not been directed solely at non-Jewish supporters of Palestinian freedom. It has also been directed at the Jewish American community, especially groups, as you already mentioned, Jewish Voice for Peace and Not in Our Name, and so on. I want to hone in on this a little bit further. Then, why is that the case? Why is it so important?
This is really a thank you for that question, because it's critically important. And so, again, the bedrock of support inside the United States for the U.S. policy of unconditionally backing Israel, a significant part of that bedrock of support has been the Jewish American community. And as I mentioned, that support is now cracking up, especially among young Jews. So the irony here is that the Israel lobby, the Zionist state, is now calling anti-genocide Jews anti-Semites. And so there's a whole history here. How do you get this massive support among the Jewish American community or among Jewish nationals of other countries for Israel? Well, the Zionist project has involved profound trauma manipulation. You have a people that Jews that are profoundly, I mean, you can't even imagine the level of trauma suffering the Holocaust. And then the Zionist project comes along and it manipulates all of that trauma. It makes Jews feel, it says to Jews, look, you have all of this grief, you have all of this suffering, you suffered the Holocaust, there is an existential threat which is still against you. And that existential threat can only be defended by you blindly defending the state of Israel. So that has been the strategy, and it is no longer working. And so you have to target Jews and Jewish organizations, which is why, again, Jewish Voices for Peace. Think about that for a minute. First of all, these are Jews. And secondly, their voices for peace, completely peaceful, and they're being banned on campuses, and they're being expelled from their universities. Many of your listeners might know that there was this massive campaign in the 1930s and especially the 1940s and into the 1950s of repression against those Jewish Americans here in the United States that were anti-Zionist, because Zionism was not the hegemonic ideology. It became so through these campaigns of repression. So Albert Einstein, in 1948, when the State of Israel was created, he was offered the presidency of Israel, be the first Israeli president. He turned it down, and he didn't just turn it down. He said, I'm turning it down because this Zionist project is fascist. That's his own words. Albert Einstein said Zionism is a fascist ideology. And then a few months later, he and 27 of the most prominent Jewish American voices of that generation, we're talking about 1948, the end of 1948, they wrote a letter to the New York Times. And I want to quote from it because I have the quote here. It warns, within the Jewish community, the Zionists have preached an admixture of ultranationalism, religious mysticism, and racial superiority. Like other fascist parties, they have been used to break strikes and have themselves pressed for the destruction of free trade unions. The Zionists in Palestine inaugurated a reign of terror. Teachers were beaten up for speaking against them. Adults were shot for not letting their children join them. And so here you see how the Zionist project has violently created a base among Jewish Americans and world Jewry, and now that is, again, I want to reiterate, is cracking up.
You mentioned the New York Times. Just in the past couple of days, there was a lengthy article put up online by The Intercept talking about how edicts have come down from up top at the New York Times, a whole list of terms, words that can and cannot be used in New York Times articles reporting on the Middle East and on what's going on in the States. Did you get a chance to look at that?
I most certainly did. You know, it shows what we already knew. Again, it's another smoking gun. We know this. We know that the corporate media, and for quite a number of reasons which we can analyze, that the corporate media is unbelievably biased towards Israel. Of course, its whole worldview of the corporate media, such as the New York Times, is the worldview, of course, of the U.S. U.S. as a hegemonic power in the world. But that revelation that you avoid all of this language, which might in any way be in the type of language which might be critical of Israel, or language which simply is telling the truth, just shows the absolute mockery, making a mockery of the claim that the corporate media involves a free press with a free exchange of ideas, with accurate and honest reporting about what's going on in the world. I mean, we've known that. You know, how many, first of all, there have been journalists that have been fired from the New York Times and the other corporate media. Remember, CNN removed its, I don't remember the details, but in late 2023, removed its Arab and Middle Eastern announcers, you know, reporters, correspondents. And there have been plenty of journalists who have been fired, but from the New York or resigned from the New York Times or from other media outlets. But let's remember something else: the role of self-censorship. If you are a journalist and you want to keep your job, and we're in an economic crisis worldwide, it's not easy to find jobs. There's less and less journalist jobs because of digitalization of the news and so forth. You either self-censor so you can keep your job and pay your mortgage and take care of your necessities. And if you don't self-censor, you run the risk of being fired or not being hired, and not just that, being blacklisted. So this is an absolute farce of what a free press is supposed to be. It's not a force keeping a spotlight on democracy and challenges to democracy. It's actually, I think it was Noam Chomsky or somebody who said it's a fourth power of state is the corporate media.
William Robinson, Jade, our producer, just passed me a note from a caller called. He has a question here that we can bears repeating, I guess. That is, this show is directly quoting the Israeli government. Curious as to how that info is obtained. How did your guest or WRT get this info?
Yeah, that's a great question. So here's the thing. You have to understand. So it was reported by Ynet News, which is the largest, one of the most largest and respected media outlets in Israel. But so inside Israel, this is not controversial news because of the total hegemony of Zionist ideology and the fascist atmosphere that has been whipped up in Israel right now. You have polls coming from Israel, and you know, I'm sorry to say this, but in Israel, you see fascism bubbling right up to the surface now. Polls show that 80% 80% of the Israeli population says, yeah, just get rid of the Palestinians. Just kick them out. Send them to Egypt. The Palestinians are totally and completely dehumanized, described as animals in Israel. So there's this frenzied atmosphere in Israel. So the reason I'm saying all of this, it's so scary to think about that, but also because this Israeli media outlet reports on this inside Israel. It's not scandalous. The Israelis say, "Oh, okay, that's great. That's great. They're defending us. Our government's doing what it's supposed to do: defend us." When we get that news here, and again, it was totally ignored by the corporate media. Total news blackout. But when we get the news here, it shocks us. But you have to see that the news was released right to an Israeli media outlet for the Israeli news reading public. And they're not fazed by this. They think this is something good. I mean, it's the same way that we here in the United States, to use a simplified term, brainwashed but indoctrinated, you know, to think that the crimes that the U.S. government commits all around the world is defending our freedom and our democracy. So we're indoctrinated in that way here. So again, this news, when it hits the Israeli public in that country, they don't see this as scandalous or anything. In fact, it was just minor news there.
We have two callers waiting to get on with a question or observation. Let's go to the first caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Me?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say that all the pushback from, you know, different Jewish American groups is a result of nobody actually knowing, or most Americans not knowing about what was going on in Israel and Gaza now, with the different camps and the settlement of the West Bank and all that. And I think they're very afraid of all this information getting out and Americans reacting to it and not wanting to support Israel anymore.
Thank you, caller. William Robinson.
Yeah, I could not agree more. We have, as I mentioned, Jewish Voices for Peace, but that's not the only one. We all have. We also have Never Again Action. We have the American Council for Judaism. There's many anti-Zionist Jewish organizations. They're marginalized. They're repressed. Again, they're accused themselves of being, you know, they're accused of being anti-Semitic against themselves. But you know, there's also something else going on here. I mentioned the Hezbollah, that Jewish Americans are brought free of charge and, you know, all expenses paid to Israel. So when young students on college campuses, they're brought there, they're not brought to see the Israeli Defense Forces torturing Palestinians and shooting Palestinian children and arresting them and the bloodshed and the misery of the occupation and now, of course, of the genocide. They're brought and they're taken around the country and getting a very partialized view of Israel as this wonderful country defending and celebrating Judaism. I have had several students. I've been a professor at UC now for 23 years and before that at other universities. I've had over the years, maybe 6-7 students who are Jewish Americans. They came to my classes and they we do discuss these issues. And they explained to the whole class, they said, look, I was invited to Israel and all I saw were all these wonderful things. It wasn't until I get to classes such as yours, professor, that I see what's really going on in Israel against the Palestinians. So this is, again, part of the key Zionist strategy has been to indoctrinate the Jewish American population.
We have one remaining caller. We're getting short of time here, so I want to bring them up. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for the show. It's lovely. Alan, William, I want to ask, what are your ideas of how can we put pressure on AIPAC and the Zion Christians? And I was thinking, how can we drive a wedge between these two ironically joined parties?
That is a great question. Of course, I don't have answers beyond what we are already doing, which is, well, I think, one, the role of public education and public awareness is so critical, and we are seeing that. I want to mention something in this regard, that Israel, and again, Israel, the United States, because you really can't separate them. Israel, the United States, they control the military battlefield, whether it's in Gaza right now, whether it's in the occupied territories, whether it's beyond. However, Israel and the United States have already lost the battle for political legitimacy, for world public opinion. The International Court of Justice preliminary ruling has really been a watershed turning point, and this mass upsurge of opposition to genocide and now to Zionism. So the political tide is already changing. And your question is excellent. How can we combat all of this? Mm-hmm. I don't have specific answers beyond continuing exactly what we are doing and beyond reiterating that this incredible escalation of repression against us. And really, I want to reiterate suspension of the U.S. Constitution on our campuses. It is reactive. It is a reaction to the fact that they are losing the political battle. Their ironclad control over the U.S. political system, it is now being seriously, seriously questioned. A long way to go, of course, before we change that. But look, the U.S. political system is now fracturing. The Democratic Party is deeply divided. There's mass opposition to Biden and he's genocide Joe because of his unconditional support for this genocide. So again, I don't have the answer on what more we can do, but continuing doing what we're doing is already having its effect.
We have a little bit of time left in the hour. If you want to get in with a quick call or question, 608-256-2001. William Robinson, I want to talk about longer historical precedents for what we're witnessing here. You said, you know, before that, for instance, the strictures on Jews in Eastern Europe not being able to go into the professions in the 20s under the Horthy regime in Hungary, as an example. And then I don't think it's – some people have used the term a kind of neo-McCarthyism, what we're seeing now. Talk about that.
Right. Well, so let's put something in historical context here. Anti-Zionism bubbles and percolates throughout Eastern and Western Europe for centuries, anti-Semitism for centuries. It's bubbling right below the surface, and it breaks out in pogroms in Russia, and culminates in the Holocaust. So where did Zionist movement, which was born in the 1880s, 1890s, where did that fit in with this fight against anti-Semitism? Now, as hard as this is to believe, and this is all thoroughly documented, Herzl is the father of Zionism. He published his diaries. So we have all of this historic evidence. The Zionist movement says, we're not going to combat anti-Semitism in Europe. On the contrary, we're going to turn anti-Semites in Europe and anti-Semitic governments in Europe into our allies, because their objective was to set up a Jewish exclusive state in Palestine, meaning ethnically cleanse and get rid of the Palestinians. And so we want Jews in Europe to go to Palestine. So we're not going to combat anti-Semitism in Europe. And we're going to work with the U.S. and the U.K. governments and lobby them to not accept Jewish refugees. This is actual, well-documented history. So the United Kingdom and the U.S. turned away Jewish refugees fleeing from the Holocaust, fleeing from the Nazis. And the Zionists supported and lobbied for that because they wanted them to go and colonize Palestine and to ethnically cleanse Palestine. So again, this is part of the larger history here. There is so much. And of course, this is completely suppressed. If I even mention what I'm mentioning now, which again, historically documented, empirically documented facts of history, I'm accused of being anti-Semitic. I could get in trouble on my campus.
Some of the best work on such topics comes from Israeli dissident historians. I've always found that very interesting. While I'm at it, I might as well plug, if people want to get some background, I would check out Ilan Pape, P-A-P-P-E, his primer called 10 Myths About Israel, that's available in print, came out a few years ago, but I've been reading it lately, and it's helped in clarifying a whole bunch of thought. Do we have anyone on the line, Jack? No.
Absolutely, I would encourage readers read anything written by Ilan Pape, which, as you pointed out, is a Jewish Israeli, highly respected historian who has basically been forced into exile. But I wanted to mention, you don't have to necessarily be dissident. Benny Morris is considered the premier historian in Israel. He's a Zionist. I mean, he actually is defending this genocide. It's horrible. But in his scholarly work, he has been honest enough to actually examine the historic record and not try to hide it. So you can even go to this pro-Zionist, Benny Morris, and he wrote a whole book on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, showing the unbelievable terror unleashed to ethnically cleanse Palestine for the creation and massacre Palestinians for the creation of the Israeli state.
Of course, Benny Morris went on later on to state that one of his concerns was that the Jewish military in 48, or excuse me, the Zionist military, see, I even conflate them, that the Zionist military establishment did not do the job they should have to begin with.
That's right. I mean, Benny Morris, he's such an enigmatic figure because, again, he's really, fascist in his thinking. Yet, because he's an historian and he wants to respect his own scholarly integrity, he has examined the historical records, the archives when they were opened up, the Israeli archives, and he's in his work, he's very honest on talking about that ethnic cleansing. His political positions are another thing. They're really, honestly, fascist now. They're genocidal political positions.
We're right down to the end of the hour. Some parting words. Just a few minutes left, a few moments.
Well, I just quote, final thoughts? Here's the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of press or of the right of people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I just wanted to read that section of the U.S. Constitution because, as I mentioned, we are literally seeing a suspension of the U.S. Constitution on our university campuses. We should be deeply worried about that because even beyond this issue of the genocide, that suspension is going to be used for all and every progressive cause and liberal cause on our campuses and off our campuses.
Well, you have to leave it there, William Robinson. You've been listening to William Robinson from the University of California, Santa Barbara. I want to thank Jack for engineering today, Jade for helping to produce. I want to thank you callers, listeners. I'll be your host again next week. This is Alan Ruffin. I'll be talking with you next week.
To send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree. And hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be recorded.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with an admission that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The head of the Kenyan Defence Forces, General Francis Ogola, has been killed in a helicopter crash, together with 9 other senior military officers. Rescue and recovery teams have been dispatched to the site in Rift Valley in the west. This report from Richard Hamilton.
Reports say the military helicopter went down in flames in the Rift Valley. 2 survivors have been taken to hospital. President Ruto described the death of General Ogola as a tragic moment as well as a personal loss to himself. He said Kenya had lost one of its most valiant generals. General Ogola had been appointed to the position in April last year. He had previously been the commander of the Air Force.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has given a bleak assessment of the war in Gaza, warning of a full-scale regional conflict. Alluding to Iran's attack on Israel, he said the